everybody, and welcome back to Fueling Forward Friday. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former elite runner. Today's episode, I will be answering questions you all have submitted to me beforehand. And if you would like to submit any questions in the future, you can do so at my website, www.fuelingforward.com, under the podcast tab, or you can send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. Not sure if you can hear the helicopter behind me, but I am not kidding you. Every single time I've gone to record an episode, there's been a helicopter circling my apartment. So figured this time I'd let you guys hear the background noises of living in LA. Welcome to the Fueling Forward podcast. It's great to have you guys here. Happy Friday. Happy 4th of July. I hope everyone has fun plans for the weekend. It's always nice when a holiday like this falls on a Friday or a Monday so you can get a nice long weekend. So hopefully you guys are getting to take advantage of that and enjoy some downtime. Nick and I are not doing much out here. I'll probably be working a little bit as per usual. Pros and cons of owning your own business. And one of the cons is that it can be hard to take days off completely. But that's okay. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And speaking of my business, Fueling Forward, before we get into today's questions, couple quick Fueling Forward announcements. The first one is that my fall marathon group coaching program applications are open. So if you are competing in a fall marathon, and I would define that as anything between October and December, anything between Chicago and CIM, this program would be a really great resource for you if you're interested in learning more about nutrition for the marathon. Basically, over the course of 12 weeks in a group setting, I'm going to be walking you guys through how to fuel day to day. So how to build your plates, how to balance carbs, protein, color for performance, how to fuel on off days, easy days, hard days. We're going to talk about the importance of practicing your race day fueling plan, give you guys some guidelines and some recommendations for how to do that, hydration, electrolytes, talking about fueling before and after training, snacks, how to fit everything into your day if you have a busy schedule. It's going to be super fun. And since I'm also running New York, I'm just really excited to have this be a fun group environment that we can all kind of work together towards our goals. That's something I love about the sport is that it just brings people together. So it's already about halfway full. So if you are interested in the program, you can just head to my website, go to the group coaching program tab. I'll put a link in the show notes here as well. If you're interested, go ahead and fill out an application. I would love to have you in the program. I am limiting it to 10 athletes, so that way people will still feel like they're getting the full experience. There's going to be a group page where you can post questions, and I'll be in there answering questions and posting resources, and it'll be a lot of fun with a lot of really cool stuff. So if you're interested in that, definitely look into that. Don't hesitate to reach out if you have any questions, and if you're not sure if that's a good fit, happy to help answer questions. The second announcement, as I said already, I'm going to be running the New York City Marathon as a charity runner for Track Girls. And Track Girls is a nonprofit organization that is working to create mentorship programs and resources for girls in sport through track and field. And it's just such a special organization. They're doing a lot of really fantastic work to help keep girls in sport, especially in lower income communities. So if you guys have any interest in supporting me on that journey, my goal is to raise $4,500 for them by November. I'm going to put a link in the show notes again to donate if you're interested. Anything and everything helps. So greatly appreciate in advance any and all donations and support with that. The other thing I wanted to just briefly talk about, I would be remiss not to, is Faith Kipyegon's sub-4 attempt. I don't know if you guys watched or are familiar at all with the project. It was really cool to see, really brave to see somebody put themselves out there like that. You know, all of us who've ever raced, we know how scary it can be to line up on the start line, even just with our own goals that feel ambitious, whether or not people know about our goals. So I was really inspired by Faith's just very public attempt at something that was really difficult. So if you weren't able to watch that, highly recommend watching the replay. I have thoughts in general on, you know, pros and cons of the way that I think it was done. But for me, at the end of the day, I just am really inspired by the bravery that Faith had to go for it. So incredible athlete, incredible story. Highly recommend rewatching that if you haven't already. Okay, so we'll go ahead and jump into today's questions. Our first question says, "Hi, Maddie. I'm a high school cross country athlete, and I was wondering if you had any tips or recommendations for fueling when you run at night. My cross country team sometimes meets in the morning, but on the days where I can't make it or a day where we run on our own, I'm either busy during the day and it's hot out, so I end up running at night around 7 or 9 p.m. What would you recommend as far as fueling and recovery suggestions? Thank you." Yeah, that's a great question. I know it can be really difficult to navigate fueling for afternoon workouts, evening workouts for sure. A lot of my races, like when I was racing on the track, the 5K, the 10K, those races would be at 9, 10 o'clock at night. So I completely understand that it can be pretty tricky to figure out the timing of that. What I recommend athletes to do, and this would go for whether you have a race at night or if you have a workout in the evening or afternoon, you know, after work, for example, I recommend working backwards from the start time of your run. So if you're going to be running at 7 o'clock at night, I would say you probably want to have a small pre-run snack around 6 o'clock. And then roughly every 3-ish hours backwards from there is how I would think about eating. So a 7 o'clock workout, you know, having something small at 6 o'clock, you'd probably end up wanting to have like 2 kind of smaller lunches. So maybe something at 3 and something at noon, have maybe a mid-morning snack around 10 o'clock, and then a bigger breakfast around 7. So you're still hitting all those fueling times throughout the day. As you get closer to the run itself, I recommend really trying to prioritize easy to digest carbs. So think white rice, white bread or sourdough bread, white pasta, not a lot of fiber. So I would not go here for the things like brown rice, quinoa, salad, you know, avoid tons of fruits or veggies, things that are just going to take longer to digest. Keep protein pretty basic. So, you know, like a turkey sandwich, or pasta with chicken, you know, avoiding things that might have a lot more fat in them, which are harder to digest. And again, keeping fat to a minimum as well. So generally, rule of thumb, fat, fiber, protein, keep that pretty minimal in the few hours leading up to your workout. So let's say you were going to have 2 lunches. You had a normal lunch at noon. Maybe this was something like that turkey sandwich with a side of pretzels and some carrot sticks. That's a pretty simple lunch. We're getting our carbs, color, and protein, but we're not getting a ton of fiber. We're getting some protein. We're getting some fats, which is fine when we're 5-7 hours out from our run. But then our 3 o'clock quote-unquote lunch or meal, second lunch, keeping that pretty simple. So something like a bagel with peanut butter and a banana. So something that's going to settle really well, give you easy energy, quick to digest energy, not sit in your stomach like a brick. Again, we're not thinking about as much the protein here. You know, having some protein, like I've mentioned this before, but bagels actually usually have 10 to 15 grams of protein per bagel. So you're still getting protein. If we add a little bit of peanut butter, we're getting some protein, some fats, but generally speaking, that's going to be a pretty easy to digest option. And then maybe at 6 o'clock, we have something really small, like a small granola bar. Like I love those Clif Kid Z bars, like the oatmeal, iced oatmeal cookie Z bars or the Made Good version. Something small like that, fig bars, some graham crackers, something easy on your stomach, pure carbs, you know, about an hour before that run. If you're running late, if you're running at like 9 o'clock, you know, in this situation, if it's not a race, you probably do want to have dinner, probably an earlier dinner, maybe around like 5 o'clock. And then you could have a smaller snack again, maybe at like 8 o'clock before that run. So if we're having dinner before we run, again, we do want to try to keep that pretty simple. So for example, if you were going to do like pasta, you know, keep that pretty basic, maybe pasta with light sauce or olive oil. You know, there are some things like garlic and onions or heavy tomato sauces, those things can sometimes not settle super well for an evening run. So if that's the case, maybe like a rice bowl would be a better option for you, like white rice with some chicken, maybe a little bit of veggies, some soy sauce, you know, something pretty simple. And then having that pre-run snack, that little granola bar, maybe around 8 o'clock. Those are kind of the different ways I would do that. If you're having a pre-run dinner at 5, again, working backwards, maybe you have a snack at 2 o'clock, you have lunch at 11, and then you have breakfast at 8 o'clock, or, you know, breakfast at 6 o'clock and a snack in between, whatever your morning schedule looks like. So again, just kind of thinking about what time am I running? I want to have something small about an hour before that run, and then I want to be eating about every 3 hours backwards from that. So you can kind of figure out your schedule that way. And the closer you get to the run, the more you want to focus on carbs, the less you want to focus on fat, fiber, and protein. That's just the way I would simplify it. The last thing I'll mention is electrolytes and fluids throughout the day. If you're running or training later in the day, I recommend trying to make sure you have electrolytes throughout the day. So at least the water bottle that you're finishing leading up to your workout, making sure you're putting electrolytes in there. You could also have more electrolytes throughout the rest of the day as well to kind of preload with hydration. But either way, making sure you're hydrating, adding in those electrolytes, especially leading into the run itself. For post-run, if you're doing a workout at 7 o'clock, chances are you're not going to be done until 9 o'clock. I would try to have something that resembles a meal, but keeping in mind that you probably won't be able to have a huge meal if you're going to go to bed right after that. That might be uncomfortable. So maybe that rice bowl that I mentioned earlier, you could kind of do like a smaller meal, a bigger snack with chicken, rice, some veggies, and some hydration before you go to bed. If you're on the later side of that, like you're running at 9 o'clock, you're not going to be done until really late, then you probably just want to have something small with carbs and protein before you go to bed. So this might be a good time for a drinkable option, like a smoothie or a protein drink with some carbs on the side, like a small bar, applesauce pouch, something that's going to give you at least 20 grams of protein, at least 60 grams of carbs, you know, and then depending on how much time you have before you lay down and go to bed, a little bit of time to digest that. But that's a great question I get asked a lot about, how do I fuel for evening or nighttime runs? So that would be my recommendation. If you're somebody who's running after work at 5 or 6 o'clock, you know, same thing, keeping your lunch really simple, that rice bowl or easy pasta dish around, you know, noon or one, and then having your pre-run snack maybe around 3, and then heading out for your run after work. If that was the case, if you were running, you know, at 5 or 6 o'clock and you're having lunch at noon, you'd want to have a snack that's a little bit more substantial in between. So something, think like a Clif bar with a banana. One of my favorite things, and I would bring this to school all the time in college, was a flour tortilla with peanut butter, banana slices, honey, and cinnamon. And then you just roll it up into a little like burrito thing. And I would eat that before my runs. It's a really good amount of carbs, always settles really well for me. So that's a super easy thing. Those Kodiak cake, like pancake cups, I love those before runs. Those always settle well and have a little bit more protein too. So easy things to have if you're at work and you're going to be running after work. That could be a good snack to have maybe around 3 or 4 o'clock. All right, this next question is from Megan, and Megan asked, I heard you mention on one of your Q&A podcasts that artificial sweeteners affect gut health. I was hoping you could expand on this a little. I add stevia to my coffee. Should I stop using it? Thank you. Great question, Megan. I'm really glad that you brought this up, because I think especially today, things like stevia or monk fruit, what we call non-nutritive sweeteners, are really popular. And the issue that I have with them, well, I guess I should say there's a couple things that I'm thinking about as a dietitian. The first one is the fact that these are non-nutritive sweeteners because our body can't digest them. So there are no calorie sweeteners because our body doesn't know how to get anything from them. Our body doesn't know how to break them down. So by ingesting them, you know, we're not getting any calories, any energy from them because we can't use them. But those products that, you know, say zero sugar, they're still very sweet. So obviously that's where those non-nutritive sweeteners are coming in. They're providing sweetness without calories. Why are we trying to remove more carbs? Why are we trying to remove more sugar? And while I understand that we don't necessarily want to be, you know, drinking, eating a ton of foods with added sugar, our body knows how to digest sugar. It knows how to digest glucose. It knows how to digest table sugar, maple syrup, honey. Our body knows what to do with that. It doesn't know what to do with those things like stevia or monk fruit. And either way, those substances are going to come into contact with our gut. They're just so new. There's just not enough research on them for us to know, are these things safe to consume long term? What is a safe quantity for us to consume in a day, a month, a week, a year? What does that actually look like? And if we exceed that quantity, what happens? These are just questions that we don't have the answers to. And I think we're always, as a society, looking for ways to cut out sugar and cut back on carbs and low fat, low sugar, this and that. But again, those products change a lot over the decades because we learn more about the science behind the things we're using instead. So for a while, like aspartame was a really popular non-nutritive sweetener. That's in something like Sweet and Low or Splenda. Sweet and Low and Splenda are good examples. Like those were all the rage back in like the 70s, 60s, right? When it was like the Atkins diet, no sugar. But we learned later that those are carcinogens, that they can be linked to increased risk for cancer. And that was something we didn't know at the time, right? So the issue that I have with these non-nutritive sweeteners, part of it is that we just don't know enough about them for me to feel comfortable saying, let's be consuming these in large quantities. And they are in everything, right? Like all these drinks, all these bars, all these products, they're everywhere. You know, there is a little bit of research that's starting to emerge on some of these non-nutritive sweeteners. And we have seen that they can alter the balance of the bacteria in the gut, potentially leading to more of a decrease in the beneficial bacteria or the good bacteria that we want in our gut, and an increase in the potentially harmful bacteria or the ones that we don't want as present. They can also influence the metabolic activities of our gut bacteria. So it impacts how our gut bacteria actually process nutrients and whether or not they're producing beneficial or harmful byproducts. So some of the bacteria in our gut are responsible for producing byproducts that help improve our gut health. They help protect our intestinal barrier. They reduce inflammation. They help prevent overgrowth of harmful bacteria. Whereas some byproducts from bacteria can be more inflammatory inducing byproducts, or they can be toxins that create issues, or they can be histamines that cause us to react to foods. So anytime that we're introducing something that could potentially alter that gut microbiome, we just don't know how much of an impact that will have. Again, what quantity of that substance it's going to take to have a negative impact. And at the end of the day, yes, stevia is coming from a plant. Yes, monk fruit is coming from a plant, but it's still altered. And I would argue, why is that any better than cane sugar, which is coming from a plant? So, you know, I think that's just one side of it, which is like the safety and the efficacy. We just don't know enough. The other issue that I have as a dietitian that I sort of touched on earlier, are we choosing these non-nutritive sweeteners, these zero sugar products, because they're better for us? Or are we choosing them because we're afraid of sugar? Because we're trying to cut out carbs? Or because diet culture still has its talons in us as a society, which it definitely does? And I would argue putting a little bit of regular sugar in your coffee, that's not going to be harmful. And again, your body actually knows how to digest that. But if we're doing things like replacing sugar with stevia or choosing energy bars that don't have sugar, are we making those choices because they're healthier? Or are we making those choices because we might have a little bit of fear around a certain food? And that can be a slippery slope to disordered eating. I'm not judging you at all or telling you that you have an issue with your relationship with food, but I definitely think it's important to reflect on why am I making that choice And in some products, you know, again, if I have an athlete who is wanting to have a bar on the go because they don't have any other convenient option, those bars that have a lot of non-nutritive sweeteners typically cause stomach issues when it comes to runs. And on top of that, those bars don't have as many carbs because they don't use sugar. So then we're actually not getting as much energy out of them, and it kind of defeats the purpose. So in general, I'm not a huge fan of products that use those non-nutritive sweeteners. I also just can't stand the taste of stevia or monk fruit. I think it's just so overpowering. So it's just not for me. But I think if you are somebody who consumes those products, if you like them, that's totally fine. I think just be conscientious of how much you're using them, why you're making those decisions, and if there might be a better alternative out there. But either way, you know, I think everything in moderation, right? There's room for all those foods. So if you genuinely enjoy the flavor of stevia in your coffee, that's totally fine. But maybe you limit stevia in your other products. Instead of choosing bars that contain stevia, you choose a bar that has real sugar, maple syrup, or something like that. So, you know, it's, again, it's okay to be consuming things, sugar or stevia or otherwise, as long as we are not using them as a tool to avoid certain things, or, you know, starting to make those replacements as kind of a gateway into disordered eating. Just being honest with yourself about why you're making those choices, and just being conscious of the quantity in which you're consuming those things, just because we don't have enough research either way to determine if they're safe or not, long-term use, how much we should be consuming in general, just some of those things to think about. But another question I get all the time, so thank you so much for asking that question, Megan. Okay, this next question comes from Krista. Krista says, "Hi, Maddie. I recently discovered your pod and I'm loving it. Thank you for all you do. In a couple of episodes, you've mentioned that most runners do not even hit close to the recommended carb intake. This really resonated with me as I've been focused on protein intake while limiting carb intake for years and have been in an in and out of injury cycles for a similar amount of time. Because of this, I've started to up my carb intake for the last couple weeks, and I've actually started to notice a positive change in my energy levels as I run and race. However, despite the increased energy levels I'm experiencing, I'm also noticing that my belly is more bloated and I'm feeling overall just a little heavier. Is this something I should expect from this change in my diet? I guess there's a part of me that is really scared of adding weight as I add in the carbs. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks again." Krista, that's so exciting to hear. First of all, congratulations on making that shift to adding more carbs. I know that's not easy to do, and I love to hear that you're already feeling some of the benefits to adding more carbs. That's amazing. So congratulations. Really great work with that. Your question is one, again, that I get a lot, and, you know, I completely understand where you're coming from all across the board. Fear of body changes, fear of weight changes, that's probably the number one barrier I have seen in my practice to runners adding more carbs. We've just really been taught to fear them throughout our lives, and we've kind of been taught that eating more carbs means we're going to gain weight. And that is not always the case. And sometimes, yes, our body does shift, but again, that can be nuanced, because if we're under eating and we're not getting enough carbs, when we start adequately fueling, sometimes we do see weight go up. But again, sometimes that needs to happen for us to get to a healthier place. Sometimes that actually means now we have the building blocks available to build muscle. So I just had this conversation with one of my clients the other day. They were feeling stressed about, you know, seeing that the scale had gone up. I would say generally I try to recommend runners avoid weighing themselves, which is a totally different conversation. But we started talking about, you know, how are you feeling in training? And she was like, you know what, I just realized I hit my deadlift PR the other day. I lifted heavier than I ever have. I'm feeling a lot stronger on my runs. I absolutely crushed my hill workout the other day, and normally I'm really gassed towards the end. So we kind of realized, like, oh, that's an increase in muscle mass, which is going to cause the number on the scale to go up, but it's also going to help you feel and perform better. So weight changes inherently are not always a bad thing. And I would argue, weight changes, in my opinion, shouldn't be thought of as good or bad. They should just be another data point. It's one measure of health. It's one measure of performance. But there's a lot of other things that are more important to look at, like energy levels and how you're feeling. When I hear something like my belly is feeling more bloated, that to me could indicate a couple of things. Sometimes we're adding more fiber along with those carbs. So for example, adding in more brown rice or whole wheat bread, whole wheat pasta. I've had some runners a lot of times incorporating like a high fiber tortilla or something, like a sort of like a carb conscious option. So even though it's a tortilla, there's not a lot of quote unquote net carbs in there. And the term net carbs just refers to how many carbs you're actually digesting when you take away the amount of fiber that's present in a product. So that's why there can be like keto bagels, for example, if you guys have seen those. They have 20 grams of carbs, but they have 19 grams of fiber. So there's only 1 gram of carb that you're actually getting from it. So don't even get me started on the gut issues that people would have from eating a keto bagel. But sometimes when athletes are adding in more carbs, they don't realize that they're adding in items that contain a lot of fiber. So maybe fiber intake has gone up a lot. So if that's something you're noticing, I would recommend switching to just a simpler, lower fiber option and getting your fiber from color. So, you know, if you're having, again, a rice bowl, you're going to have fiber in the veggies that are in your rice bowl. So maybe just using white rice for that purpose. The other thing that Krista mentioned is that she's been really focused on protein intake. So if as a runner, if we're adding in more carbs, sometimes that actually means we need to scale back our protein. Maybe it just means that we're maybe overeating at a meal now if we're continuing to eat the same amount of protein and now we're adding all these carbs and now we're feeling uncomfortably full after a meal. So if that's the case, thinking about scaling back protein a little bit at your meals to see if that helps with the bloating. Sometimes it's just an overly full feeling. Again, it's not a bad thing if you overeat sometimes. It can be a good opportunity for feedback and to learn more and say, okay, maybe I need to adjust portions or, you know, maybe I need to scale back protein so that I can continue to focus on my carbs. A lot of runners, if they've been hyper-focused on protein, are getting too much protein anyway. So that's something that's okay for us to cut back on a little bit, especially if we're adding more carbs. And those foods, like I've mentioned, don't exist in isolated forms. A bagel, which has more carbs, also has 10 to 15 grams of protein. So sometimes even adding the carbs, we are getting more protein. And if we were overshooting protein in the past, we need to adjust that a little bit to account for that increase in carbs. So generally, if you are someone who's been hyper-focused on protein, thinking about limiting protein at meals to about 30 grams and aiming for around 10 to 15 grams of protein at snacks, that can help you scale that back a little bit so you can fill the rest of your plate with the carbs and adding your color in as well. That could help with the bloating. The last thing I'll say with the bloating is sometimes it's actually related to stress. So I hear you mentioned some fear about adding weight when you add in carbs and a history of potentially under eating carbs. That to me puts up a little red flag in my dietitian brain that maybe we have some fear around carbs. Maybe we have some stress around carbs. So when we're eating more, even though that's maybe something we should be doing and know we want to focus on, it can cause stress, and stress can cause GI issues. So if you're noticing stress at mealtime, especially because we're adding more carbs, what I recommend doing is just taking a few deep breaths when you sit down to eat. As silly as that sounds, it can kind of get your body out of that fight or flight mode, in which case you're not as good at digesting because fight or flight mode shuts down your digestive system. Whereas if we're in the rest and digest phase, more of that parasympathetic nervous system, that's when our body stimulates our digestive system to be active. So sometimes if we're really stressed going into a meal, we don't digest as well. And then we have more issues after the meal, like bloating. So thinking about what is my mental state when I'm sitting down to eat? Is this maybe contributing? And can I do something to manage my stress at meals? Occasionally too, it's liquid. So if you're drinking a lot of especially carbonated liquids with your meals, or you're drinking a large volume of liquids with meals, sometimes that can cause some bloating. So just a couple things to think about if you're noticing a change in how you're feeling after meals, thinking backwards from, is it a new food that I'm eating? Am I feeling stressed around this food? Did I add in a lot more fiber that I maybe didn't need? Or maybe I now am getting way too much protein. Can I scale that back to make room for these carbs? So a couple things just to think about. And the last part of your question was that you're feeling overall a little bit heavier. And this is actually common when athletes add more carbs. And Steph Bruce touched on this last week in her episode when we were talking about carb loading for the marathon. So anytime you're storing carbohydrates as muscle glycogen, you pull water into that tissue. So for every 3 grams of muscle glycogen you store, you also store 1 gram of water. So that's something to think about with that heavy feeling, or even noticing the number on the scale going up. Sometimes it's not even a shift in body composition or weight at all. Sometimes it's just a fluid shift or a energy store shift. Now we have full energy stores, and because of that, we have more fluid on board. That's probably going to cause us to feel a little bit heavier. But as the run goes on, and as you start using up your muscle glycogen stores, you also release that water. And you'll notice as your run goes on, maybe you start to feel a little bit better, or that kind of dissipates throughout your training session. So sometimes those shifts are just naturally going to happen, and they feel new because maybe we've never had full glycogen stores before, and that's why you're feeling better with your energy and your running. It's not a bad thing that you're feeling that kind of heaviness. It's something that might just take some time to get used to because it's a new sensation, but it's actually for a positive reason, which is that your energy stores are more full, you have more fluid on board, which is also helpful for performance. So all around, I know those shifts can be really stressful, and we tend to be hyper aware of any body shifts that are happening. But a lot of times that one variable, changing your carb intake, or even seeing the weight on the scale go up, is just one piece of the puzzle. It's not the only cause of what's happening, and it's not the only factor that we're thinking about. There's a lot of other things that could be contributing to what we're feeling. So just reading your body, tuning in, trying to challenge yourself in those moments where you're noticing fear or stress, and focusing on the positive. You feel better. You have more energy. Those are huge wins. Those are very important pieces for training. So again, Krista, completely empathize with you in that. You are certainly not alone in that fear, that struggle. I talk to athletes about this all the time, but I love to hear that you've made those changes and you're seeing some positive changes as a result. That makes me so happy to hear. Keep up the great work. Keep challenging yourself. It will definitely be worth it. Okay, the last question in today's episode says, I'm a high school upperclassman and a devoted cross-country and long-distance track runner. I've been running seriously for many years now, since middle school, and have never gotten my period. Assuming this is amenorrhea, what are possible ways that would help me get my period and still be a successful runner? Really awesome question. I appreciate you reaching out with this. I know this can be a hard thing to talk about and to acknowledge, so I appreciate your courage in asking this question. There's definitely a couple things to break down here. So I don't know how old this runner is. If you're an upperclassman, my guess is you're at least 15. So amenorrhea, meaning the absence of a period for at least 3 months or more, is considered to be the case if you have not gotten your period by the age of 15. So assuming this athlete is above 15, that would be considered amenorrhea. There can be different causes of amenorrhea. Most commonly in runners, it's an energy imbalance. But occasionally there are other things happening. So anytime that you haven't had a period, if you're feeling concerned, I do recommend checking in with a medical professional. So meeting with your primary care or your pediatric doctor, potentially, you know, meeting with an OBGYN, getting some blood work done, just ruling out anything else that could be going on causing you to have an absent cycle. Sometimes there's thyroid conditions, sometimes, you know, there's other things that are going on, genetic or otherwise, that are interfering. So, you know, making sure if you are concerned that you are taking a look at that. More commonly, in my experience, again, this is not medical advice and I'm not diagnosing anybody, but in my experience, this is typically related to training and fueling and there being an imbalance between the energy that you're expending versus the energy that you're putting back in. It's not always related to weight. So a lot of athletes will say, well, I'm a healthy weight, or I don't look that lean. I don't look that skinny. Maybe I'm not underweight. Maybe I have other teammates who weigh more than I do, you know, or less than I do, or whatever it may be. I've said this before, but REDS, relative energy deficiency in sport, disordered eating, eating disorders, they don't discriminate against body type. Anyone can be experiencing this at any size. It does not only happen to athletes that look really lean or underweight or anything like that. The other thing to keep in mind too is that this can happen even if you don't struggle with your relationship with food. So that's the other thing I hear a lot from athletes is, well, I don't have an eating disorder. I don't have disordered eating. I eat really well. I eat everything. So there's no way that I'm dealing with this. For a lot of high school athletes, it's unintentional because you don't realize how high your energy needs are. And you live such a busy life that a lot of times high schoolers are just missing out on the amount of food they need to be eating because they have so much going on. So if you're an athlete who has amenorrhea related to underfueling and training, there are a couple things you can work on to try to get your period back, assuming you've checked with a medical professional and you kind of know there's nothing else going on. The first thing athletes hear is eat more. And yes, this is true, eat more. But I know that can be a frustrating thing to hear because you're like, well, what does that mean? How do I do that? I'm full all the time or I'm not hungry. How do I do that? I know this can be tricky because sometimes too with underfueling, you can have a suppressed appetite. So you might just not feel hungry and then it's hard to know when to eat. So a couple ways you can work on eating more. The first thing is by getting onto a fueling schedule. So making sure that you're not going more than 3 hours without eating. This might mean you need to set alarms. This might mean you need to eat even when you're not hungry, which I know can be difficult. But those appetite hormones will come back. And every athlete I've worked with where we've had to take this approach, after about 2 weeks of kind of pushing through that discomfort, they notice that their appetite's coming back, their signals are coming back, and it gets easier. So the first thing is kind of getting into that fueling schedule of fueling consistently. And this also helps prevent within-day deficits. So that's another factor when it comes to getting your period back, is if you're spending long periods of time in an energy deficit, that actually increases your risk of amenorrhea. There's been research studies that have shown that athletes, even if they're eating enough calories in a day, if they're going too long without eating, they're at a higher risk for REDS or missing their period. So eating consistently is definitely important, and it's an easy way to help you eat more. Another way that you can eat more is by incorporating more fats, and this is another piece of the puzzle that will help get your period back. All of our hormones are made using cholesterol and fats. So we need to make sure we're eating enough dietary fats in order for our body to have the building blocks that it needs to make hormones, to have a regular period. So things like whole fat dairy instead of non-fat dairy, adding avocado to toast, adding 2 tablespoons of peanut butter instead of 1, adding butter, cooking in more oil, adding more salad dressing. These are easy ways to get more calories and get more fats to support hormone health without feeling like you're increasing your volume of food, which, like I mentioned earlier, if your appetite is suppressed, can be really difficult. So adding in more fats, more energy-dense foods can really help with that as well. The third thing would be carbohydrates. So there's a direct relationship between eating enough carbohydrates and producing estrogen. Insulin, which is a hormone that our body releases to manage our blood sugar, it's going to release insulin in response to eating carbohydrates. If our body is not producing enough insulin, meaning we're not eating enough carbohydrates, it actually suppresses estrogen. So getting enough carbohydrates is another really important piece of maintaining a regular period. So maybe this means you switch from one piece of toast to two pieces of toast. Maybe you switch from toast to a bagel, which is going to have double the amount of carbs. Maybe you add some juice with your meals instead of water. You use electrolytes that have carbs in them instead of non-sugar electrolytes. So again, thinking back to those like no sugar, low sugar products, those are not going to be helpful for somebody who's trying to get their period back. So really focusing on adding more carbs. Another thing is fiber. This is something I see a lot in athletes who struggle with amenorrhea. They're eating a lot of fiber-rich foods. And again, it can be confusing coming from a dietitian telling them to eat less fruits and vegetables. But if we're overeating fiber, one, we're causing ourselves to feel really full because it's taking up a lot of space in our stomach, but it's not a lot of calories or carbs or protein. The second issue is that if we eat too much fiber, again, excess fiber intake can disrupt estrogen, can remove more estrogen from our system and affect the balance. So reducing fiber intake is another thing that's important. And that's where that plate model can be really helpful, aiming for half of your plate as carbohydrates and trying to get two sources of carbohydrates. So think about like two fists of carbohydrates at your meals. Only one fist or one quarter of your plate as color. So maybe that means you need to decrease the size of your veggies at dinner and increase the portion size of your carbs. Again, like I mentioned earlier, if you're having stomach issues from eating more carbs, it could be a fiber issue. So reducing that from brown rice to white rice, some of those swaps can be really helpful with getting your period back as well. And then the last thing is actually stress management. There was a really interesting research study done on 8 women who lost their periods, and they had all of them go to therapy, develop some tools to manage their stress, and 7 out of 8 of them got their periods back without changing anything else. So stress plays a big role in hormones as well. So keeping in mind stress management can be helpful too. A concern I hear a lot from athletes is, does this mean I need to stop training if I want to get my period back? The answer is not always. You know, sometimes scaling back on training is necessary or helpful, especially because if we are experiencing amenorrhea from low energy availability, that just means the more energy that we're expending, the more we have to put back in to meet that surplus so that we can get your period back. Meaning that if you're already struggling to eat enough food just to support your training, getting the extra amount that we need to get your period back is going to be harder if you're more active. So sometimes all that means is we're adding in one rest day a week if we haven't already been doing that, which is something I encourage all high schoolers to have at least one day completely off. No cross training, no intentional activity, just an off day, a full rest day. Another option might be maybe we replace our easy runs with some cross training or lower intensity, lower volume things. Swimming, maybe biking, elliptical, again, within reason. We're not replacing a 45-minute run with a 90-minute swim. It doesn't quite work that way. It's cutting back on the volume, cutting back on the load on the body. But maybe we add in a cross training day, take away an easy run day. So it's not always the case where we need to do that. And I've had a lot of athletes who've been able to get their periods back maintaining their same training volume. But if you are struggling with that relationship with food piece and we're still training, it typically makes it more difficult to get you to the point where you're going to get your period or get it back. So just a few things to think about. I know that's a lot of changes. If you are an athlete who is struggling with missing your period, there are some really great resources out there. Riley Beatty, who is on my podcast a few weeks ago, has a period recovery program for any athlete who's lost their period. So really cool resource to check out. I work with athletes to get their periods back. That's also something that I'm very passionate about. You know, speaking with sports medicine physicians who are aware of the term REDS or Red S, who know that amenorrhea or not having a period is not normal. Something in this person's question said, can I get my period and still be a successful runner? You know, that I think what I'm hearing in that verbiage is that there's a fear that getting your period means you're going to be a slower runner. And I would actually argue, and science would argue, that having a period makes you a better athlete. It improves your tendon health, your muscle health, your bone health. It allows you to get stronger. It improves your endurance capacity because under fueling, under eating, being in a state of REDS decreases your aerobic capacity, decreases and worsens your running economy, decreases your ability to store muscle glycogen, which takes away from how much energy you have to complete a run, increases your risk of having things like low iron, which affects your oxygen carrying capacity, so you can't run as hard or as far. So there's a lot of reasons why having a regular period would actually make you a better athlete. I also just briefly want to mention that birth control, going on birth control to quote unquote kickstart your period, it doesn't really work that way. Typically, you will get a period on hormonal birth control because you'll experience what's called a withdrawal bleed, but it doesn't mean that your hormone levels are where they should be to protect against bone density loss, or that not enough to mean that you are in a healthy place with your fueling. It's just not something we can use as an indicator. So of course, everyone is different, and I am not telling anyone not to take hormonal birth control, but I think a lot of sports medicine professionals are quick to encourage young runners who don't have a period to go on the pill to kickstart it. And I just encourage you, or if you're a parent of a young runner in this position, advocate for yourselves, for your athlete, advocate for a different approach, something that's going to get to the root cause and actually treat this from the root issue, not just mask it with this essentially fake period. So just wanted to throw that out there. I know a lot of parents don't know this, and I've had a lot of parents tell me that when I've worked with athletes who haven't had a period, they wish that they had known that. I'm not shaming anyone who is on birth control. That's not what this is for. I think everyone needs to make the decision that's best for them, but I just wanted to mention that. So great question. All around really great questions today. Thank you guys so much for writing in. I'm loving the questions that I'm getting, so please keep it up. I want to hear from you, even if it's not specific nutrition. Again, I'm a runner and I love to answer running related questions. I answered one of those a couple weeks ago. So anyway, I just love hearing from all of you. Thank you so much for being here, and I hope you all have a wonderful 4th of July. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. If you'd like to submit a question to be answered on air, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.